A kiss on the hand may be quite continental, but diamonds are a girl.
Diamonds are cemented in pop culture, from classic songs by Marilyn Monroe to James Bond movies.
Diamonds are forever.
To a recent Rihanna hit.
We're beautiful like diamonds in the sky.
Americans buy more of these precious gems than any other consumer, but they weren't always so coveted. They're a marketing success story thanks to the diamond company De Beers. It once had a monopoly on the market. With a stockpile of diamonds, it convinced consumers they're a rare gem. De Beers came up with that slogan, "A diamond is forever." But diamond mines are not.
Diamond mines, the larger ones, are starting to dry up. An expert I spoke to said that, economically speaking, diamond mining may only have up to 30 years left.
De Beers, you know, one of the biggest mined diamond producers in the world, if not the biggest, announced that they would begin selling lab-grown diamonds after many years of kind of steadfastly not doing that. Basically, that brought a lot of panic to the industry because De Beers was kind of severely undercutting its competitors, in some cases by up to 75%.
You can't tell. I mean, really and truly, there are lab-grown diamonds now. They're perfect diamonds. They're everything that a diamond is. You can't tell because the technology to create the stones has outstripped our ability to tell the difference between them.
This episode, we go into a startup to see how lab-grown diamonds are made. Will consumers think they're as dazzling? And how will they change the $82 billion diamond jewelry industry?
The future of everything. A look ahead from the Wall Street Journal with Jennifer Strong.
New York City's Diamond District is one of the largest in the world. The street is lined with armored trucks, security guards, and people trying to hustle you into their shops.
Diamonds, you want to buy diamonds?
Selling old diamonds?
Though it may sound like a flea market, the Diamond District is anything but. We're headed to one of the last remaining diamond-cutting factories in Manhattan. It's inside the offices of a third-generation diamond dealer called Jack Reese. We're greeted by armed guards and doors that look like they belong on a bank vault. Upstairs, we meet the company's CEO, Ephraim Reese. He's assessing a raw, uncut diamond straight from the mine.
First of all, have you ever seen a piece of rough?
No.
No. Okay, so now you're going to see one. This is...
Oh, wow.
This is a piece of rough.
Really? Wow.
This comes from Botswana. This weighs 13 carat and 86 points.
It looks like a piece of sea glass, smooth and cloudy. Cutting and polishing this into stones worthy of several engagement rings is all about economics. Reese plugs information into a computer program, and it helps him figure out the best way to cut it.
So we try to play around with this to get it to a point where we can get the biggest percentage with the best clarity, and that's what's happening here.
It wasn't always this way. Until recently, he did these calculations by hand.
We're cutting around this diamond, and we're getting a 7-carat cushion. That is one of the scenarios. And right here, we have a 746 pear shape. But this pear shape has a problem. If you notice, do you see this? Mm-hmm. There's a little piece of imperfection in here. How much is this going to cost me extra? And then at the end of the day, I have to make a decision. Where am I going? How am I taking it?
We move from his office into the factory, where diamonds are cut and polished, a trade that's passed down here from father to son.
This is the cutting process. This wheel, how fast does it rotate? 25,000 times a minute. It's all diamond powder on the wheel. The only way to cut a diamond is with diamond. It scrapes and scrapes and scrapes. And when you're ready to bring out the luster, this is called the polish line.
This is how diamonds are cut and polished all around the world. For Reese, the job is about tradition.
I love what I do. I enjoy what I do. My father was a cutter. I was a cutter. And I really enjoy the business.
But for both family operations and legacy brands, the diamond business is shifting. In its diamond industry report, Bain & Company says some of the world's biggest mines are expected to run dry by 2030.
So there is actually quite a lot of points of discussion on this. It's not as clear-cut and polished as diamonds might be themselves.
Oliver Griffin covers mining for Dow Jones.
Diamonds are formed very deep in the earth, up to 200 kilometers down. And they're propelled upwards by very specific volcanic activity. Geologists say there hasn't been this sort of eruption that they've spotted for millions of years. So it's hard to tell where the next one will be to propel more diamonds to the surface.
In May, De Beers shocked the industry by announcing its new lab-grown diamond line the night before the jewelry industry's largest trade show. The company had long promoted the value of mined diamonds over lab-grown stones. Its new subsidiary, Lightbox Jewelry, is selling diamonds that undercut competitors, in some cases, by more than 75%. To understand why this is such a big deal, we have to get into De Beers' history.
De Beers was founded in 1888 by a group of British businessmen, and it kind of grew from that. Its name is really synonymous with diamond mining.
De Beers held a monopoly on rough diamond production for most of the 20th century. During the Great Depression, the company stockpiled its supply to prop up prices. It made diamonds seem more valuable and rare. In the 1950s, the company paid the Soviet Union above market value for rough diamonds in exchange for the exclusive right to sell them. Meanwhile, De Beers launched a campaign that transformed the industry. Wendy Yothers teaches jewelry design at the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York.
In the United States, the popularity of diamond rings and diamonds in general declined after World War I and came almost to a crashing collapse with the Great Depression.
De Beers needed to rebuild the market to make money off its monopoly. In 1939, it coined the four C's.
Carat, cut, color, and clarity. That was pretty interesting because that established a benchmark for quality, and that would increase the perception of the stability of value.
Next, De Beers rolled out its now iconic marketing with the phrase, a diamond is forever.
The marketing goal of De Beers was to persuade the public that an engagement ring is indestructible, it's indispensable, and it's a symbol of prosperity, and that the diamond is the only acceptable stone that you could ever put in a ring. They went a step further by pushing the idea that you're a cheap fellow if you don't spend a month's pay, and then by the 80s, it's, well, maybe 2 months.
The diamond engagement ring. How else could 2 months' salary last forever? A diamond is forever.
It worked. Within 3 years, diamond sales increased by 50%. But then the fall of the Soviet Union happened, and De Beers lost its monopoly. Some people in the industry think the company's investment in lab-grown diamond jewelry is an attempt to recapture the market. De Beers denies this. Regardless, it signals a shift in the industry. In July, the Federal Trade Commission removed the word synthetic from its recommended list of terms marketers can use when selling lab-grown diamonds. It also removed the word natural from its definition of a diamond, because mined or man-made.
You can't tell. I mean, really and truly, there are lab-grown diamonds now. They're perfect diamonds. They're everything that a diamond is. And unless a signature is placed in that stone somewhere to indicate that it's lab-grown, you can't tell because the technology to create the stones has outstripped our ability to tell the difference between them.
They are chemically identical to mined diamonds.
Lee Camping Carter is an editor at The Future of Everything.
This is not like a cubic zirconium, which is an imitation of a diamond. You know, if you are looking at it with scientific equipment, you can't really tell the difference. And you certainly can't to the naked eye.
Lab-grown diamonds are made using a process called chemical vapor deposition.
So basically, engineers in the lab start with a seed, which is a piece of existing lab-grown diamond. At Lightbox, they put a few hundred seeds at a time in a plasma reactor, which someone at Lightbox described to me as basically a giant microwave. They run that at 7,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and they pump in a bunch of gases, a proprietary mix of gases, and basically carbon atoms in the gases kind of deposit onto those seeds layer by layer. They kind of cook them in there for 400 to 500 hours, which is about 2 to 3 weeks. That gives them stones that are big enough, you know, rough diamonds that are big enough to kind of polish into a 1-carat gemstone.
The payoff?
You can make as many of these as you want in a lab in, you know, a few weeks.
One lab-growing diamond startup that's gotten a lot of attention is Diamond Foundry. Its investors include founders of Google, Twitter, eBay, and Facebook, as well as Leonardo DiCaprio.
I'm in the middle of South San Francisco, which is better known as kind of the birthplace of biotech and There's a Genentech bus going by. There's self-storage, freight companies, some shipping containers strewn about.
It's not the place you'd expect to find a factory full of diamonds. The building is unmarked, and it's just as confusing inside. The previous tenants were tile distributors, and their displays are still on the walls. Also, the people who work here largely wear the Silicon Valley uniform. Khakis, a fleece, no jewelry, except maybe a smartwatch.
So what we're stepping into here is our seed preparation area.
Jeremy Scholes is one of the founders of Diamond Foundry. The company sells its gems as carbon neutral and sustainable.
Every one of our diamonds starts as a diamond seed. This is just a thin sliver of diamond, and it contains the atomic blueprint for a single crystal diamond. Our process works by adding carbon atoms one at a time to the surface of this diamond seed. And what the diamond seed does, it provides the pattern where all of those atoms have to go.
It's about the size of a couple of apple seeds, but flatter. They place this small piece of natural diamond in a plasma reactor where it grows into a diamond that's atomically the same thing as one that's been mined.
On the other side of that door is where the actual addition of various atoms occurs. Once we've grown carbon on top of these seeds for a few weeks, we get one of these. This is a rough diamond block, and at this point, it is just like mined diamond pulled out of the ground. It's treated in exactly the same way.
It looks exactly like the one I saw in the Diamond District in New York.
On the other side of these doors is where actual diamond is grown.
All right.
So you have just entered the world's most sophisticated diamond mine.
Kyle Gazay is another co-founder.
Everything that you see in here is our own proprietary technology built from the ground up.
What you see is rows of our production reactors. All of them are growing diamond currently. It takes a few weeks of cycle time before the finished diamonds pop out.
So in other words, we're standing in a very unassuming room with perhaps millions of dollars of diamonds?
The answer to that question is yes. We make our way back out to the factory floor.
After stones come out of the reactors, they come back into this area where they're sorted for quality. Just like mine stones, we produce a distribution of diamond sizes and qualities.
Just like mine stones, the clarity and color varies from one to the next, and can only be cut with another diamond or a laser.
So what you're looking at is a diamond block. There's some material on the edge of that block that isn't useful for the cutting process. So we remove that by laser. And the little block of light that you see dancing around the outside of that stone is a laser actually burning away the small amounts of diamond that we're cutting through in the process.
The last stop on this tour also looks familiar. It's the same polishing process I saw in the Diamond District, with a twist.
So what you're looking at here is a little robot arm, which is holding a single diamond against a polishing wheel. The wheel is steel with impregnated diamond, so we're actually cutting diamond with diamond. These automated machines do part of the work, and then Chris over here finishes up every single stone by hand.
We have the technology to make real diamonds quickly and in unlimited quantities. But does that help or hurt the diamond market? De Beers seems to be straddling the line between embracing man-made stones and pushing mined stones' rarity. Lightbox only sells studs 1 carat and smaller, and it doesn't sell engagement rings at all. Again, reporter Oliver Griffin.
Well, De Beers themselves say that they're very clear this is a move into the sort of fun jewelry range. They believe that they've listened to their customers and that what they want is a sort of fun, light-hearted take on diamond jewelry for events that aren't so special. However, they still insist that, you know, for things like a birth, an engagement, that mined diamonds are the only real way to go. Whereas Diamond Foundry, they don't see this distinction.
If diamonds become easier and cheaper to get, will they lose their luster? And will this change what the industry's biggest seller, engagement rings, represents?
Will the symbol of diamonds change in 30 to 40 years? Possibly. If mined diamonds do become an absolute rarity, the price will just go up. especially if demand is still fed by a lab-grown, not replacement, but alternative.
While De Beers insists millennials are spending the same on diamonds as previous generations, surveys show that younger people are getting married later and spending more money on experiences instead of stuff.
Even talking amongst peers, the idea that a diamond you spend 2 months' salary on an engagement ring seems like something that, you know, everyone I've spoken to is much more interested in saving for things like cars and houses. And these are people, you know, they've got long-term partners. It's something that maybe they are considering, I don't know. But I guess symbols change over time.
The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. This episode was produced by Kristen Schwab, Garrett Crow, and Emma Silikens, with help from Oliver Griffin and Lee Camping Carter. Our technical director is Jacob Gorski. John Wardock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Strong in the newsroom in New York.